You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
This is episode 278 of Horsemanship Radio, brought to you today by Hands On Gloves, the all-in-one revolutionary bathing, grooming, shedding gloves. Our intrepid host, Debbie Laux, is out and about gathering intel for upcoming episodes. So sit back and enjoy this classic featuring Dr. Andrew McLean, founder of the Australian Equine Behavior Center, and Dr. Susan Raymond from the University of Guelph, Equine Guelph.
Dr. Susan Raymond is Communication and Programs Officer, Equine Guelph at the University of Guelph, Ontario, Canada. Susan is heavily involved in the education programs at Equine Guelph, and she's an instructor and a course creator of the management of the equine environment. She was involved in the air quality research, which provided the practical recommendations to the horse industry on stable design and management. And Susan has completed her PhD investigating the effects of, are you ready for this, exposure of horses to myotoxins. That's dangerous. Welcome, Dr. Susan Raymond.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
It's our treat. I love what you've done in all the research and all the things that you've done with horses, and your background really are perfect for Horsemanship Radio. I'm excited to share you with all of our listeners. I love how you talk about safety first. How important is that to you?
I think it's very important in terms of, I think we as horse owners and those that are involved with horses, sometimes we don't give enough appreciation in terms of our own safety or for the safety of our horses. And it's very much a, you know, a fun thing to go out and work with our horses. That's why we do it. But we sometimes don't always look at the whole environment and some of the dangers and safety aspects that are, that can be found in that environment.
Mm. And when you say environment, I was reading some of the research that you've done, and it's not just safety for you. It is creating an equine environment based on toxins and air quality and all those. Tell me a little bit more about that. I've never known a scientist that studied the air quality in a stable, so I'm curious while we've got you here.
Right. Now we're looking back quite a few years ago, but I'm very interested in what we can do as horse owners to both prevent problems from occurring and also treat some problems after they have occurred. We take our horses and we put them in somewhat artificial environments in terms of housing them indoors, depending on where we're coming from in geographical regions. And we're mm-hmm. also in the same indoor environment. And I think it's very important to look at both how we design our facilities, but then also all the organic matter that we place inside our barns, mainly hay and bedding, and just what that effect can have on our horses that might be stabled for quite a few hours every day. One thing to point out with horses, they're a little bit different than other livestock groups. We don't really expect our chickens and pigs to run marathons, but our horses are mainly, in some cases, they're high-level athletes. We also, for the most part, allow our horses to live out a longer lifespan, so they can be exposed to a great many different housing situations throughout their lifetime. And the same as with people, both people and horses, as we age, we can develop different sorts of issues in terms of environmental sensitivities.
Mm-hmm. Allergies, things like that as well, yeah?
Exactly. Allergies and, you know, some other environmental sensitivities and, you know, asthma, somewhat related issues with both people and with horses as well.
Sure. So air quality, it makes good sense. We've got a huge oxygen machine in a horse, and we expect that of them if they carry us around at all or drive or anything. What's the ratio? Is there a perfect ratio? I know you're in Ontario, so I know it's difficult to be outside in some part, sometimes of the seasons, but is there a perfect ratio of being outdoors to being indoors for horses, if we could come up with one?
I think it'd be really hard to come up with an actual ratio, both in terms of what we expect from our horses vary between discipline to discipline and breed to breed. And also in terms of environmental conditions, it really varies from how enclosed up a barn is. One barn is not the same. One housing situation is not the same from barn to barn to barn. We do a wide variety in the horse industry. I think looking in terms of having your horses outside as much as possible, and you raise the point of geographic region, and of course today is a very snowy, cold day up in Ontario.
Is it?
And having our horses outside all the time isn't, as you said, always practical. The same with very hot regions. It may not be practical to have them outside all the time, you know, for opposite reasons. So I think looking at housing your horses as much as possible outside, and if you can't house them outside 24 hours a day, if it's not practical or if it's not feasible for that discipline, looking at the environment inside, both with design for all seasons that you're exposed to, and then also management of the organic material that's in your barn, both for the good of you and your horse.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're in there working too, I suppose, maybe not as long as the horses, but so you've probably been all over the world looking at barn designs and housing designs. Is that right?
Somewhat. We've done a lot of things that are traveling, but also with our one strength of, in terms of our online programs, is we have students and guest speakers from all over the world. So one, I guess, perk in terms of being involved with this type of program is I get to peek inside virtually the barns of people from all over the world, and same with other students that are involved with our programs. We get to see exposures of what happens in, Australia versus what's happening in Canada and Eastern Canada and Western, and then the U.S. and also more tropical regions as well.
And so I imagine you're going to say that the design should be different for the different environments. But if you had to have the design today that you think in the current research, what would it look like? Tell us what a maybe six stall barn might look like.
I think at one point it varies in terms of what you're going to use the animals for. But I guess in an ideal situation, I would look at having access to the outside from the stalls. Would be a real, if you have the space. If we're looking at unlimited space and resources, having access to outside, looking at a well-designed ventilated barn. If, for example, in our region, we have winter and summer and fall, spring. We also have humidity variations between daytime and evening. So looking at a barn that's actually designed in the wintertime, when you close up all the windows and doors, it still is well ventilated. And I think that's an important point that sometimes is overlooked. Looking at what types of beddings that we're using in the barn, making sure the horse is not, ideally not in the barn, but at least not in the stall when we're mucking out. Things like that, looking at whole management options as well.
Good. And okay, so maybe the height of what makes a well-ventilated barn, even if you've got cold or heat outside, is it the ceiling heights? Is it the openness, the closeness?
There's a variety of things. One is looking at, ideally a barn should have permanent openings. So these are inlets and outlets that are designed within the facility that are open all the time. Saying that, we don't want drafts on our horses. So there should be good air distribution from stall to stall to stall. You don't want a very well-ventilated center aisle, but stagnant air in the stalls where the horses are.
Right.
So looking at ventilation. Also, depending on the geographic situation, looking at insulating your barn might also be of interest. It really varies. You have to look at the region where you're designing your barn, and that will really have an impact on how it's designed.
Okay. And tell me about bedding, because, that made good sense when you said that out loud, that if you've got a lot of particulates floating around in the air that are coming from the bedding, that would bring down the air quality, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's the two main sources traditionally in a horse barn in terms of sources of dust are both the forage and the bedding. Traditional forage is long-stemmed traditional hay, and that can really vary in terms of the dust and mold, in terms of how it's the season of which it's in terms of the growing, both growing, harvesting, and how it's stored has an impact on its quality. The same is true for bedding. One popular bedding is straw bedding, and the concerns with straw bedding is it's generally not as absorbent as some other beddings. It can be quite dusty, and also depending on the growing season and how it's taken off the field and stored, it can also be quite moldy. When we look at some of our other beddings, a good quality shavings or some of the other non-traditional beddings can be quite absorbent and lower in dust than, say, a straw bedding.
What do you like? What do you use for your horses? Because I know you're a rider.
I am a rider. Unfortunately, I do not have a horse at the moment. It really varies, but my favorite bedding of choice is a good quality shavings bedding. That's my preference, but that can really vary as well. And I have come across, I was fortunate years ago with all the research, practical research that we were involved in, I had exposure to a lot of different types of bedding, from peat moss to some of the recycled paper products, and some of the, there's a lot of compressed wood pellet beddings that are on the market now.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, especially in Canada, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's an ebb and flow in terms of what's on the market and in terms of what natural resources are being used in terms of what products. There's a lot of good quality beddings out there, but I would really caution people to really do their homework, make sure that the product that you're purchasing as a bedding is truly an animal bedding and isn't, say, a byproduct from another industry. It's not just a waste product. It's something that's quite important in terms of the quality that we put into our barns.
Is there a fear that there's chemicals in there or something that would be unhealthy for the horse?
Oh, absolutely, yes. There's some, if you have access to, say, a free horse bedding, you might want to take a look at what it is.
I see.
there's lots of different products that are out there that may not be suitable for horse beddings. When we look at wood products, you don't want anything that has been finished at all in terms of has any preservatives in it, any sort of waste wood products. There's things that with waste wood, there could be glues or other sorts of things that have been used in the processing. When we look at things like paper beddings, there can be some very good quality paper beddings, but you also don't want things that have, say, glossy prints and heavy metals in the ink, glues or staples. It's wonderful to make use of a recycled product, but you have to look at, what the product is and how it was stored as well, because a lot of recycled products, they can be exposed to a lot of moisture and mold. So I think, again, you have to do your homework in terms of what bedding that you're choosing.
Well, that's great. You're really caregivers. You're a holistic approach to the whole design and management of the barn then.
Yeah, I think we take on this responsibility of our horses and of ourselves. And I think we really have to look at the whole picture. We tend to, some people, we might get tied up in terms of the romantic view of being involved with our horses, which is wonderful, but we have to look at caring for them in terms of all their needs and then our own as well. And then I feel if you look at different aspects of horse housing, if you do it in a responsible fashion, it will be both responsible for you and your horse and safe for you and the environment. And it's a whole, I think everything is part and parcel with itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So I don't know how you got into this. I know that you said that you've ridden young racehorses before. You've been in jumping, dressage, trail riding, and even dabbling in endurance now. What is a ride and tie? Is that where you go overnight?
That's sort of my more recent foray into the horse industry, but that's involved with the endurance riding and a ride and tie. It's quite exciting. They're races with one horse and two people. And the one rider is on the horse. They start off, and they're usually quite long in terms of distance. And at some point, the person will get off their horse, tie it somewhere, and then you as the runner will find your horse, get on it. Then it's sort of a leapfrog effect.
So
basically you have two people for every horse that's in the race. And it's a lot of fun. It's a way to get out there and do some riding, outside with a bunch of other good people. And they're quite exciting.
Wow, that sounds really fun. We'll have to look that up. Google a little ride and tie on there too. You'll have to come down and show it off a little bit. We'd love to have you as a guest at Monty Roberts' place in Solvang, California. It sounds like a lot of fun. You guys would have fun talking design and management. It's one of his favorite subjects, and horsemanship is definitely common ground with you guys too. So people are, you have students, you're a professor, and you have students coming to your University of Guelph University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. And are they studying what you're researching now too? Are you teaching this design and management for equine environment?
We do. What we do at Equine Guelph, we focus on online education for basically the industry. So both at a kids level and then as adult level as well. One of our main programs is with our online programs, we have both 12-week courses and then we also have specialized 2-week courses. We have a whole range of online courses from safety and then management of the equine environment and stewardship and horse behavior. And they range from, you can take them on an individual basis, but you can also build them towards both a certificate and a diploma level. With our 2-week courses, we focus on very concrete subjects within a 2-week period. So we have colic prevention, equine biosecurity, and then a horse behavior and safety course as well.
Fantastic. Biosecurity.
So that's reducing the risk of infectious disease. So it's infectious disease specialized course.
Fantastic.
I have a question.
Please, Jen.
If I might jump in. Can stables that are set up for biosecurity, for example, a quarantine facility, and a stable that is set up to optimize the horse's environment to stay healthy, are they mutually exclusive or can you do both?
That's a good question. I think you can do both. I think, as you pointed out, a barn that's specifically designed as a quarantine facility with the idea that you might be housing compromised animals, it does have to be designed differently, obviously, than a stable that is more run with the idea that it's healthy animals that are in it. But there's some aspects that I think that are common for both designs.
And what would that be? What are some of the things that would have to become? Because what makes me think of that is I live here in Ocala, Florida, where horses are very transient.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's difficult for show barn managers to set up their stables in a fashion that reduces the risk of the spread of disease, because those horses, they travel all over the country, but they also travel within stables frequently. The horse will move from trainer to trainer. And are there certain aspects of a healthy, well-run stable that are common to both good biosecurity measures and a healthy environment?
Yes. Well, I know not every facility has this opportunity, but ideally you would have a special quarantine barn for your animals that are traveling. And I know not that that's the ideal situation. So you would have a set barn that has your resident population, and then the ones that travel, ideally for the first 2 weeks after they return, they would be housed in the quarantine barn. Now, I know that not every facility has that opportunity, but there's things within, if you don't have access to a separate building to house your traveling horses, there's some things that you can do within your own stable. The ones that are traveling, ideally, you would have them, say, on the outside stalls, so they're not in mixing with the rest of the horses. There's some aspects in terms of your stable management, you would then, the ones that are traveling, you would reach last in terms of feeding and mucking out. So you're not going from your resident animals that haven't traveled and back and forth to your traveling animals. So there's a lot of ideas in terms of managing how you're managing those animals and use of equipment. You might have your equipment in terms of, you know, the muck out wheelbarrows and that kind of thing, have ones that are just set aside for the ones that have just returned from travel. So that, I think there's a lot of things that people can do in terms of how they manage that they can minimize the risk of infectious disease. An important thing is just washing your hands. We know we are supposed to do that, but when we care for animals, you know, we're really touching them, touching their environment, and really, you know, looking at, you know, washing your hands between horse to horse can really have a big impact as well.
We should have a little Purell at each stall. See, Jen?
Good idea. I like that. Can I borrow that for Horse Tip Daily, please? Is it okay if I borrow that? Okay. I will.
Yeah, there's actually, if you look on our website, on the Equine Guelph site, we have a biosecurity risk calculator, and we have a lot of good information on that webpage in terms of just practical hands-on things that you can do at your own barn. We have a range of, basically, they're PDF handouts, but they deal with practical tips on what you do if you have a traveling horse, when that goes to shows and then returns, what to do at your barn, how to properly clean and disinfect your barn. So we have a lot of really good hands-on practical tips on
that
webpage.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you. We'll send people, we'll have your webpage on the show notes so that people can get to you too. Thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Well, great. You know what? I would love to have you back, Susan, if we could, to have a bit of a tip. I know you do work a little bit in the emergency rescue for horses and animals, too. I would love for you to think about a tip and be our guest again, if you don't mind. Would you do that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. We have a strong, I mean, as you said, we have a lot of different interests here at Equine Guelph, but one of our upcoming interests is emergency preparedness and large animal rescue. That would be wonderful to have another discussion about that.
Great. Thank you. Well, thanks very much, Dr. Susan Raymond, for joining us today and being with Jen and I. Next up, we meet world-renowned horse and elephant trainer after this word from Monty.
Hi, I'm Monty Roberts, and I'm dedicated to training horses without pain. You can learn to do it too on my Equus Online University. Western, English, the beginner, or the advanced rider, it doesn't matter. You can connect with other students online too, on our forum, and there's a new lesson every week. It's a lifetime of learning for you on my Equus Online University at MontyRoberts.com.
Dr. Andrew McLean brings together a rare combination of academic and equestrian achievement. He's the winner of the highest Australian science award called the Eureka Prize for Science. And he's also an accredited horse riding coach for over 30 years. He's written 5 books as well. And he's represented Australia in eventing. And he was shortlisted for the Australian team for the World Equestrian Games in Stockholm in 1990. He's ridden to Grand Prix in show jumping and FEI levels in Grand Prix and dressage. Andrew is also well known for his acclaimed systematic approach to elephant training in Nepal and India, where his work is endorsed, continued, and supported at a government level. Welcome, Dr. Andrew McLean. May I call you Andrew?
Certainly.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for honoring us with your presence. I know that you've gotten up at the wee hours. It's 6 a.m. in Australia right now, and we're just honored to have you. I just got off the phone with Monty Roberts, my dad, and he said to say hi and appreciates you being here.
Oh, thank you. We're passing on my very best regards, too.
I will do. Thank you. I'm going to jump right into your background. Not everybody knows everything about your background, but we're going to put links here so they can study what you've done. But what came first for you, horses or elephants?
Oh, horses for certain. I came from what you would call a horsey background. My mother was a top show rider and my father was a show jumper. So I was well and truly into the European sorts of riding from a very early age. And I lived on an island in between Australia and Tasmania. And on that island, all we did is, I had three brothers, and we just chased kangaroos after school on our horses and all weekend, and had a lot of fun with the horses. So the elephants really came much later in my life, in fact, in 2006.
In 2006. So you've been at that for some time. But so the horse background, you were highly competitive growing up then.
Very much so. I mean, not so much as a child, because we just did it for fun. And then I went away to boarding school, because on King Island we could only go to a low level of school. So I went away to university in Tasmania. And I took my horse with me, who was an island bred horse. His ancestors had swum ashore from a shipwreck. And my horse's mother was the first one tamed from this wild group of horses. So he had an interesting history, but he could really jump. And so when I took him to Tasmania, I started jumping, and he was certainly more skilled than I was. And I learned a lot from that horse, and he took me right to the top.
Wow. What a fun background. And so athletic. I imagine those survivors, they're probably the most athletic of the crop. I read in an article about you that your mother believed that to have a good relationship with an animal, that you should give it communication skills with people. How do you do that?
I do it simply by thinking that that's what training really is. Instead of the word training, if you think of it as communication, because in the same way as you set up a very good relationship with people by having very clear communication, mm-hmm. and you remove elements of unpredictability, so that, you know, the people that all of us love most are the ones who we can communicate with the best, where if there are any elements of unpredictability, we know what to avoid in, you know, in saying certain things. And mm-hmm. so it makes the relationship really trusting and secure. And I think it's exactly the same with the horse, that very good horsemen try to convey this, you know, that you have to be very clear and very consistent in what you do. Do it in the same way each time, and the horse begins to learn what your signals are. And in the same way, when he responds, you respond as calmly and clearly as possible. So I think that no matter what sport you do with horses, or any other animal for that matter, it's just based on very clear, consistent communication. And I think, you know, we take it for granted when you're a good, effective horse person, but most of the world are not clear. They give ambiguous signals to the horse. You know, maybe their pressure of their hand says, I want you to do something, but their body might say the opposite. And so the horse doesn't know what to react to. And they're pretty good at reacting, as you know, body and to tension. So
that's true.
I think it's one of the biggest challenges for horse people like myself and your father and a few others to try and teach people to be a whole lot more calm in their way they move amongst animals.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. Do you study the physiology of the horse that is involved in the training as well, like heartbeats, adrenaline levels, things like that? I know you're a scientist first, so...
I'm actually, first of all, a horse person. I got into science later because I was just really curious. And I did a degree in zoology, so that really got me started and got me interested in animals. But it was, of course, my love of animals that got me there in the first place.
Okay.
But then when I started to inquire about training, and particularly horses, I became an event rider, so I got into a team. I represented Australia in 1989, and it was really that major peak in my career that propelled me to go searching for a way of understanding what on earth is going on when we do what we do with horses. So that really was what the whole start of it for me was about. And then I started to look at and more recently, measuring things like, you know, with heart rate and stress and what reins do. I have some students who are measuring rein pressures that riders give when they do all the things they do in riding, and leg pressures and also a seat mat that gives pressures of seats. It's really fascinating, but it's quite complicated. So, It took us a long time to see what on earth was going on there.
Probably way above our layman rider here, which is includes me. But I am interested in your simple principles of operant conditioning for training. I know that you believe in operant conditioning for training, which is a reward system, and and that you use it both for horses and for elephants. You say it can be applied to them gently in both breeds, both species. What I know in elephants, I read that you do feed them cane, but you also habituate them to voice as well. Do you use treats for horses in training as well, or just the elephants?
Well, many people do use treats for horses. By the way, when I say it's complicated, I probably made it a bit sound too scientific. I don't mean it's complicated in any scientific sense. I just mean it's a little bit what most horse people do know, in the sense that, you know, you begin when you train a young horse using pressure release of the rein for leading forward and the leg and any kind of pressures. Everyone uses different pressures, but or different systems use different pressures, but nonetheless, it's still the release of pressure rewards the response always. That's how it works. And then from there, you start to add associated cues. So, for example, in riding the horse, it might be a seat cue, it could be a voice cue, it could whatever discipline you ride in, there'll be different types of cues that people prescribe. But it goes in that order. First of all, pressure release to train, and using some, you know, using a lot of positive reinforcement too, and then the associated cues become installed on top of that. So they're sort of like a layer on top. But the actual positive reinforcement, I do use food sometimes, clicker training, for training certain things like Piaf and Passage. That helps a lot. In fact, one of our best horses in Australia at the moment is one that I trained here. And it's interesting because when he comes back to visit me, because he's coming down my way to do a big competition, when he goes into my tie-up stalls, he immediately does Piaf.
How cute.
The place reminds him of it. I'm not as fanatical about it. I think I'm much more realistic than many, because I don't think that training with food treats is the answer to everything. Because I do think to make horses safe, they still have to learn to respond to pressure of the reins. You know, if the horse bolts off towards the freeway or towards a cliff, you're definitely going to be pulling on the reins, and you need to make sure that the cues are deeply enough established that the horse will stop. And I think that that's the most important aspect of that. But with the elephants, it's quite a different story, because, you see, we don't ever have a rope on the elephants. We don't have any restraining mechanisms. So when I first begin them, and in all the places I'm working, I work in the wildlife forests, of northern India and southern India mostly, and also in southern Nepal. And those elephants are used by the forestry to track down poachers, and there's a lot of poaching with animals. It's really awful. And so we set up this, it's a not-for-profit charity called HELP. And the HELP organization, it stands for Human Elephant Learning Program.
Thank you, yeah.
It's based on just using food rewards to reward certain behaviors, but they still begin with pressure release. We still squeeze the animal in a certain place. Sometimes we use a stick because they've got quite thick skin, but we might maybe press them with the stick. As soon as they give a glimmer of the correct reaction, we reward him with food. And elephants are good to reward because, for one thing, whereas a horse can mug you, you can train them not to, but whereas a horse might mug you for food, with the elephants, we reward them directly into the mouth. And in order to get food into the mouth, they've got to keep their trunk out of the road, and so they can't start molesting you with their trunk.
Right.
So they always put their, they soon get the hang of that. That takes about 5 minutes. And so we use cane sugar, or sometimes bits of sugar cane, sometimes palm sugar, sometimes banana, whatever they've got locally. And So as soon as the elephant gives the correct reaction of forward or backwards, all the basic things for what you might call starting him, you know, as we say in Australia, breaking the horse in. When we start or break in the elephant, we add these food rewards and we teach him to pick things up from the trunk. And then gradually we fade the food rewards away so they're not needed. But they do help get a start.
Sure. It enforces the communication there. So yeah. Are they into pressure animals like horses, into pressure?
Yes, to some extent they are, yes. And, but, you know, they soon learn that if you, you know, it's all to do with what you release for, isn't it? That, you know, if that's the trouble. If horses lean on you and then you, or move into you and you remove the pressure, then you actually reward that response. And I think that's the hard thing for a lot of people because they just don't realize they're just rewarding the wrong response all the time. And yesterday, for example, I had a 2-star rider I was helping in the cross-country section, which is some work I do quite a lot of. And the horse didn't want to go into the water. But when the rider was using his legs to urge him to go into the water, when the horse balked, the rider stopped using his legs. And so I explained to him, you probably don't realize it, but you're actually rewarding him for not going into the water.
Yeah, right.
Because the horse said, I'm not going in. And the rider said, yeah, well done, you don't need to. But yet the rider's head was saying, I really want to.
Yeah. We need to be telepathic in that case. But, yeah, so what did you tell him to do?
I said, you've got to keep going with your leg pressure and increase it when he balks and even increase it more when he goes back. But the moment he steps forward, release and say, that's the right answer to the question.
Perfect.
And then we did this for 2 minutes and suddenly he was flying into the water and loving it. And he couldn't believe that he'd gone so far with that elementary mistake. But he made the same kind of mistake in all the areas of his work. Just little small holes that I explained to him, if you tidy this up and use your pressure correctly, all those things will go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huge in all the horse training, not just eventing, but it's interesting to hear because they have so many opportunities to balk, don't they, in eventing?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
So that's why you really got to set up very clear communication signals in the beginning that when you're riding over the small jumps and teach him all the different shapes that you teach him that he must go in a straight line. Any small diversion is the wrong answer because, you know, it's easy to run out on some of these what we call skinny jumps when they're very narrow. In fact, that's the way eventing is going these days. When I was eventing back in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, the big jumps were just big and dangerous. But now they're to make it safer. Because I think since 1998, we've had something like 48 riders have died in competition. It's been quite a deadly sport. And they did need to tidy it up. And so in doing so, they made the jumps much safer, but much more technical, so narrower jumps.
Narrower jumps. So that's that. It's interesting you say that because one of the biggest challenges in racing is when a horse feels claustrophobic going into those starting stalls or starting gates, as some places call it. So is that the concept that you're working on, is this narrowing is a bit more of a challenge for that sneaking through it?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and that's the trouble. I mean, and not just loading into barrier stalls, but also loading into the trailer, going into any sort of confined area. You know, they're really animals of the open grassland, and going into dark places is something that they just naturally find a bad idea, because I guess that's where you're more likely to be attacked. And I even, in my work with dressage, it's fascinating. I do a lot of work with a metronome, and so I measure the speed of one leg on a circle because it makes a difference because the horse has to do dressage. And if you keep the horse, make sure the rider squeezes the horse to go a bit faster when he slows and slows him down when he goes a little bit too fast, it's amazing what a calming effect that has. And I began to wonder why is it that the rhythm is so important, just keeping a rhythm? I think it's so true in all sports. And I started to realize that's probably why humans march to war, that if you could, instead of a ragtag bunch of people going off with a weapon to war, if you got them all to basically walk in the same beat with the same stride length, you got more confidence out of them. It kept them more disciplined.
That's interesting.
I think it's the same with the horse. So what I notice is that when I'm teaching in an arena, and it may be an arena with brush on the side or wooden rails, doesn't really matter, but as they head towards a barrier, they start to slow down. And as they get to the barrier, they speed up and run away a little bit. And the difference is only about 2 or 3 beats a minute. But if you catch that and just speed the horse up a little bit as he slows towards the wall and then steady him on the way away from it, they become really calm. And we've even shown it with heart rate monitors. So I think it's the same thing about as the horse being claustrophobic. I think it's, you know, horses, they just love the open spaces and so much. It makes them feel safe because there aren't too many animals that are faster than a horse, given them a bit of distance and open space. But they're more likely to be, you know, captured in a confinement area.
Yes, yeah, they're not quite cave dwellers. That's the carnivore, I think, mostly, right?
Yeah,
it's not the flight animal. Yeah. I read somewhere that you said that it takes a while for people to drop their weapons. I assume you mean that metaphorically. I was just thinking of that when you were marching off to war. But when they're training, is that like a crutch for people before they can build their confidence to use their pressure and release and more of your techniques?
I think so. I think it's one of the big dangers of using any kind of training weapon, anything that can hurt the horse, is that you instead of, sometimes you need to do something, you know, like with the dually halter, to increase the pressure to get the horse to do the right reaction, but then very soon it becomes as light as a feather. And it's the same with anything that you use. The big problem is that if people don't have the tact and the timing, they end up hanging on to them for too long. So the real art of the whole teaching, and I think it's not easy to get everyone to do it. I think it's probably not so difficult to get the majority to do it well, but there's always that small number of people that their timing is not so good, and they tend to get it a bit wrong. Just naturally, the timing is so different amongst us all. In my work at the university, if I throw I often throw a ball in the air, and I get all the students in the classroom to clap when the ball is at the highest point. And there's always a few who just never get it.
Oh.
They can't predict that moment.
Raise your hand, please.
Yeah, that's right. It's not me. I don't want to volunteer for that one. Yeah, that makes good sense. It does, that we all have muscle memory as well as, you know, it's little things like how much your parents threw balls around when you were little and you got that muscle memory going too. I think brains are trained, but they can also, you know, it is hard for people that have been around horses their whole life and trained in the traditional methods to change that muscle memory, even if their brain wants them to so badly. But I think that's probably our challenge for those of us over 50s that are looking to really get away from that, maybe a harsher pull on things and a little less pressure on the reins.
Yeah, that's right. And you can't ban them from riding. So the thing is to just teach them. But I always think knowledge is power, and if you can teach people how things work, then whatever discipline they do, when I teach people to do things that I've never done in my entire life, for example, the Western riding that we call it Western riding that you guys do in the States so much, it's big here, but it's not that big. But my background's in European riding. But regardless, I do teach quite a lot of people in that area and just find out what it is they want to do, what they're trying to achieve, and what cues they use. And then from there, I just get their timing better. Mm-hmm. And it really is the same in every discipline. There are people with very good timing and some with a slight miss. And I think with a horse, it is so important to be absolutely perfect in your timing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some interesting studies comparing dogs to horses. And with dogs, you can be even 1 or 2 seconds late. in your, you know, if you teach a dog to sit, you can say good boy 2 seconds late and he will know that he's being rewarded for sitting. But for the horse, you've got to be really on time.
Really quick, huh? What do you say that is? Is that 2 seconds these days or 3 seconds? 1 second?
I think you really have to be on the moment, but I think probably span a few seconds. But I just think that he loses the plot of the average task quite quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting aspect. You know, it's because the horse, see, the dog, like all predators, has a prefrontal cortex like we do, where they can imagine, visualize time, and you can project ahead, and you can think retrospectively, and we take it for granted that, you know, that because we can do it, all animals can do it, but all animals can't do it, and the limitations can be huge or a little bit. So chimps and dolphins can do a fair bit of it because they're a cooperative predator in a complex environment. Animals that are also cooperative, like dogs and lions, can do quite a bit of it. Animals like cats can do a little bit less, but they can still do some. And foxes, they're opportunistic predators, but not cooperative so much. Mm-hmm. And but grazers and browsers struggle with it more. And I think that's why we see them fairly similar. And perhaps the only exception would be the elephant as a grazer and browser. But I think he's got a head start because it's got a trunk. And so when you've got something like a hand and you can pick things up, you have to be able to imagine what you're going to do with that thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Andrew, mentioning about timing brought a question to my mind. You see a variety of ideal response times with different horses and different humans. So do you think that the horse's previous experience with humans has a effect on what his ideal response time is going to be when you're dealing with a simple pressure release situation? For example, if you have a horse that's had a lot of poorly done traditional training and you're trying to take that animal and help him understand what genuine pressure and release means, is that horse going to be more, is his response time going to be more critical than one who's, for example, a blank slate Mustang or Brumby off the range?
Yes, I think definitely that's a huge factor in it. And that's always the trouble for training horses, is that if you can get the horse that's basically naive, it's going to be a much easier prospect to train, because you know everything's new, and if you do it well, he'll learn it well. But when you've got a horse that's had problems in the past with training and he's had quite confused and poor training, definitely the timing is much more critical, and they will go through a range of other responses. And so I often think of it rather in a kind of mechanistic way, that when you ask a horse a question with any kind of pressure, be it lead, rein or leg, you know, he has like a pull-down list, like on a computer. And what you want is that at the top of the pull-down list, you want the right answer to be, but it's not always at the top. It's sometimes at the bottom. So, you know, you first might hop on this horse and squeeze him forward, but his reaction is not to go forward. His reaction might be to go backwards or stall or kick out or rear or spin or bite your leg. And so, you know, it's really, that's where pressure release is so critical to teach him what is the right answer, because his biggest interest at that moment is to release the pressure, yet he just doesn't know how, because in the past, his bad training has caused him to learn that actually the leg pressure goes away when you kick out or when you leap. When I look at problem horses, I really imagine them as a kind of profile of all of their past, as well as their natural tendencies too. You know, like I deal a lot with warm bloods, and so warm bloods tend to be a bit slower in the pressure release department because they don't care for it so much. They're quite food motivated, so it's not an intelligence thing. They learn very quickly if you use food motivations because they just can't wait to get the food.
But I can relate.
When it comes to pressure, they'll stand and just look about. And so, you know, sometimes you have to use stronger pressures. And so that's why you see, in fact, in all the European training, they always use spurs. and mostly a whip. And because these warm bloods are so difficult to motivate, and but once you do and you get them a little bit motivated, a bit more on fire to go, then they're really good to train.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think the background makes such a big difference.
Yeah, it does. It does. And you know, I would love to get into the conversation of that you mentioned PTSD and elephants, and I imagine horses as well, which is the sort of a semi like ours post-traumatic stress disorders that have happened because and how that reacts. But we've got to give you back your day, Andrew. I hate doing it. I could listen to you all day. I know Jen feels the same way. We're really excited. I know we're going to have you to the farm at Flagazette Farms in May to be a part of our international instructors meetup. And we couldn't be more honored to have you on that first day. And everybody's been talking about it. I'm really excited. So we will get to see a little bit more of you. And if you would agree, I would love to have you back for a trainer's tip. It's something we'd love to get from those that are so learned as you, if you would have us.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Then we will see you down the road really soon, Andrew. Thank you very much for your help, Dr. Andrew McLean. Next up, we have our training tip this week with Carrie Scrimma of ACTHA. She offers a training tip. Well, you'll have to listen in. Welcome back, Carrie Scrimma. Thank you so much for agreeing to come back and giving us a little bit more of your extensive knowledge, all your experience. And I always wonder when I get to talk to somebody who has the long career that you've had and been around horses your whole life, to tell me what you like to be asked. Tell me a tip that you like to give people, because you almost always know something that seems so obvious to you, but people must ask you all the time and you like to share it. Tell me what that is.
Well, you know, there are so many little tips that are important, but I'd say one of the most things that I think that are very important to a trail rider is, you know, we've heard a lot lately in the horse world about desensitizing a horse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've heard that, Debbie, you know, I certainly think it's very important to desensitize a horse, but I also know that horses are hardwired to spook. They're a prey animal, okay? Can you desensitize a horse against everything?
No,
you can't. If you go out trail riding in the Rocky Mountains, you might run into a bear. Very few people have bears in their backyard, you know. They can't desensitize their horse. So what is it that you need to be able to do? You need to be able to ride a spook, no matter what.
There you go.
Okay?
Because
it's going to happen, no matter how much you desensitized your horse. The most important thing, I think, in riding a spook is that the riders keep their heels down.
Okay.
I think it is essential to the balance and the whole, you know, feel of a horse that riders have their legs close to the horse's side, mm-hmm. and they have their heels down, mm-hmm. because that anchors you. Your heels anchor you. They are what, you know, helps you stay down and stay with this horse.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is flexibility with the heel down. You know, it's not that you should lock your heels down and make a stiff leg. It's that the joint itself, you know, is flexible and can move.
Okay.
So when you have your heel down, you don't want to be, you know, in a rigid locked position,
uh-huh.
but there should be a flexibility in that joint. There should also be a bend in your knee,
mm-hmm.
because that helps, again, you know, with flexibility. The place where your spine meets your hips needs to be flexible, needs to be very soft. So that you can move with this horse. You know, this is a living creature. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you play tennis, your tennis racket can't do anything different from what you tell it to do.
Okay, good point.
Nor could your golf club, right? But now you're on a living, moving, breathing, you know, animal. And so your body must remain soft and flexible with the ability to move with this animal. And so, you know, I think this is the strongest tip I can give riders, is to say that I feel heels down are important to anchor you onto the horse. I feel that it is important to ride with your legs close to the horse.
Okay.
And that rigidity is an accident waiting to happen.
Uh-huh. So what I'm hearing, Carrie, being over 50, I'm hearing be flexible and don't stiffen up when your horse spooks. And I'm thinking there's a lot of women out there going, uh-oh, I got to go back to the gym. Because number one, I got to learn to breathe so I stay relaxed and don't get rigid. And then I'm going to have to be real flexible in those hips. But I guess that is the truth. You've got to stay flexible. You've got to learn to breathe. We're going to have to do a uni lesson on, you know, our Equus Online University. And we're going to have to add a component of breathing.
Breathing is, you know, it is very important to, you know, to keep breathing. I think that's how the horses, you know, they have a way of knowing when humans are frightened, and that's how they do it. You know, when we hold our breath, it changes our seat. It changes a lot of things. So that's how a horse knows. You know, if a human can stay relaxed, it's like, oh, you know, the captain thinks it's okay. Yeah. You know, why should I worry?
Must be okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's great.
So just staying relaxed on a horse is, you know, is important. But, you know, just as a brief tip, you know, a quick tip, I think it's important for riders to be flexible, to breathe, but to have their heels down.
Okay.
That's the reason. You know, a lot of people wonder, you know, why the heck does my instructor keep telling me to put my heels down?
He doesn't want you to fall off on his watch.
Also, you know, if I think I call it, you know, when I'm teaching, I call it the fatal fetal position. I call it fatal fetal. You know, what riders want to do is look down and basically assume a fetal position when something happens, and which means they kind of, their heels come up, they go onto the ball of their toes, and they look down, you know, and kind of crouch. Well, that's the fatal fetal. The next thing is going to happen is they're going to hit the ground.
We'll have to come back and talk about helmets sometime too.
Well, you know, it's sensible. Helmets are great, and they're being made, you know, better and better and more comfortable. And you know, I can't say enough good things about helmets. You know, growing up as an English rider, basically in the hunter jumper world, helmets are natural to us. Mm-hmm. They're part of the costume. You know, it's a little harder to get these cowboys.
I know, but we can do is the concessions are to head covering now. I've gotten that far, but you know, a cap is not the same. So we're going to get there. We've got scientists working on helmets that look somewhat less than a mushroom look, but they do have a brim on them anyway. But well, thank you, Carrie Scrimmon, for that additional lovely knowledge. I love having you on the show, and we'll have you back.
And that about wraps it up. For details about today's show, go to MontyRoberts.com, and there you're going to find everything Monty Roberts and the podcast. As always, we love your feedback, and a great way to do that is on social media. On Facebook, it's Monty Roberts, the one with the little blue check mark, and on X as well as Instagram, it's Monty_Roberts. And thanks again to our sponsor, Hands On Gloves. Until next time, have many happy horse hours.